Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 141 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Soyuz 1, the crash. It is a terrible scene. Komarov burned up. All the instruments burned. We must quickly find out what prevented the main parachute from unlatching. Those were the words of Chief Designer Mishin after he arrived at the Soyuz 1 crash site. Once ground control determined the landing site, the Reserve Search and Rescue Service at the town of Orenburg was called into operation to locate the descent module. It was a beautiful and sunny morning at the landing site, and visibility was evidently very good. The commander of one of the AN-12 search aircraft reported to the helicopter commander that he could see Soyuz 1 in the air. The helicopter commander began a rapid descent. Then the helicopter turned sharply to the right, and many of the group members saw the re-entry vehicle down in a green field. It was lying on its side, and the parachute could be seen right next to it. And then, the soft landing engines kicked in, which alarmed the specialist on the helicopter because the engines were supposed to switch on just before the landing of the re-entry vehicle right above the ground. The first helicopter landed 70 to 100 meters from the capsule, which was surrounded by a cloud of black smoke. The fire inside the vehicle was still very intense. The bottom of the ship, with its soft landing engines, had in fact completely burned through. Witnesses claimed that streams of molten metal were falling on the ground. Along with foam fire extinguishers, they used earth around the ship to temper the fire. The vehicle was completely destroyed while the fire was being extinguished, and the spot looked like a small earthen mound beneath the peak of which was the cover for the hatch crawlway. The rescue service originally communicated on an open channel with ground controllers at Moscow, Tyertam, and Yevpatoria, although they did speak in code. Once the rescuers had seen the ship on the ground and on fire, one of the pilots had cryptically reported, quote, "I see the object. The cosmonaut needs urgent medical attention out in the field," end quote. At that point, perhaps to preclude rumors, the search service terminated all communications with the three control centers. For the next few hours, there was no news from the site, as Mishin, Karimov, and others anxiously waited for any scrap of news. Kamanin, meanwhile, landed at Orsk Airport about 2 hours after the Soyuz 1 impact, fully expecting to meet Komarov there. Once out of his plane, he was told that the ship had landed 65 kilometers away and that it was burning and that the cosmonaut had not been found. Another unconfirmed report came in that Komarov was wounded but alive in a hospital in a town 3 kilometers from the landing site. The Air Force general decided to go directly to the landing site first, although he had been explicitly ordered to wait for a call from Moscow to report on Komarov's status. Back at the control centers, there was complete confusion. Ustinov in Moscow was frantic for information. He began calling up party secretaries in Orenburg and Orsk on special lines, but he could not reach anyone. Although the vehicle had landed at 0624 hours, Ustinov received no information on the state of the cosmonaut for the next 3.5 hours. When Kamanin arrived at the landing site, the Soyuz 1 descent module was still on fire. He was not the first high space official on the scene. Academician Grigory Petrov, the director of the Academy of Sciences Space Research Institute, had arrived there first and was directing efforts to assess the situation. There was still no sign of the cosmonaut. Local residents reported that the ship had fallen towards the earth at a great speed and that the parachute was turning and not filled with air. They confirmed the observations of the search and rescue service that at the moment of the landing, there were some explosions followed by the fire. Kamanin recalled, quote, "A cursory examination of the ship convinced me that Komarov was dead and was still in the remains of what used to be his ship. I ordered to clear out the debris on the ground and search for Komarov's body. Simultaneously, I sent one of the workers by helicopter and others by automobile to the local hospital in order to verify the story of the injured cosmonaut. After an hour of excavations at around 0930 hours, we discovered the body of cosmonaut Komarov among the remains of the ship." End quote. Finding the body had been a difficult job. One of the rescuers recalled that, quote, "The group's physicians set to work. They shoveled away the top layer of dirt from the top of the mound from the hatch cover. After the dirt and certain parts of instruments and equipment were removed, the cosmonaut's body was found lying in the center chair. The physicians cleaned the dirt and the remnants of the burned helmet phone from the head, and they pronounced the death to be from multiple injuries to the cranium, spinal cord, and bones." End quote. Kamanin, meanwhile, flew back to Orsk and personally telephoned the Central Committee Secretary, Ustinov, with the following short message. "I was at the location. Cosmonaut Komarov has died. The ship burned up. The primary parachute of the ship did not open, and the reserve parachute did not fill with air. The ship hit the ground at a speed of 35 to 40 meters per second. After impact, there was an explosion of the braking engines and a fire started. I was not able to report on the fate of the cosmonaut earlier since nobody could see anything, and during that time we extinguished the fire in the ship by covering it with dirt. Only after carrying out excavations were we able to find Komarov's body." At noon on April 24th, Ustinov called Soviet General Secretary Brezhnev, who was at an international conference of communist parties in Czechoslovakia. Ustinov also edited a TASS report that was issued after a full 12 hours of silence from the Soviet press. The official line was that although the flight had been eventless until re-entry, when the main parachute was deployed at a height of 7 kilometers, the spaceship, according to preliminary reports, crashed at great speed as the result of the parachute cords getting entangled, killing the cosmonaut Komarov. In the early afternoon, State Commission members, Karimov, Keldysh, as well as Chief Designer Mission, arrived at the impact point. Soon after that, senior engineers for the Central Design Bureau of Experimental Machine Building, including Deputy Chief Designer Pavel Tisbin, and specialists involved in the Soyuz development, arrived to catalog and inspect the entire landing area. It wasn't until the end of the day that Mission informed the Operations Control Group of Komarov's death, and that a government commission would be formed to investigate the causes of the accident. Tregub, Aganzanov, and Chertok were supposed to quickly prepare a brief report concerning all the actions the Operations Control Group had taken, all the commands issued, and an analysis of the system's operation. For the time being, it was clear that the main cause of the accident had been the failure of the parachute system. Either the re-entry control system had malfunctioned, or there had been a failure in the circuits issuing commands to open the hatches. It had to be studied. All the specialists and designers were assembled at OKB one, particularly the parachute specialist and electricians. A post-mortem analysis of possible scenarios was underway. At the firing range, commands were issued to prepare a detailed report about all glitches that had occurred during testing. On April 25th at 1 a.m., Komarov's remains arrived in Moscow. On board the aircraft with Komarov were Keldysh, Kamanin, and the other cosmonauts who had trained for the mission, Baikovsky, Gagarin, Gorbatko, Krunov, Kubashov, Nikolaev, and Yelizaev. They were met in Moscow at the airport by Komarov's wife, Valentina. His remains were then cremated and the urn placed in the Red Banner Hall of the Central House of the Soviet Army for mourners to pay homage. TASS, the Soviet news agency, reported that a decree of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR had posthumously awarded Komarov a second Gold Star Medal, and a bronze bust of the hero would be erected in his hometown. Later that morning, a large delegation of OKB-1 workers headed by Mishin went to the Central House of the Soviet Army. They brought a wreath and stood in the honor guard. The second gold star had already been pinned on red velvet next to the first in front of the urn, which was awash with flowers. The stream of Moscovites who had come to say farewell did not dry up until late in the evening. On April 26th, the public was still being admitted to the Central House of the Soviet Army. OKB-1's delegation drove in the long funeral procession from the Central House to the House of Unions. The streets and the squares were filled with crowds of people. Suchlov, Keldysh, Gagarin all spoke from the rostrum of the mausoleum at the funeral. An artillery salute thundered as the urn containing Komarov's ashes was placed in its niche in the Kremlin wall. The mourners then returned to the Central House for the commemoration. Komarov's father spoke and said that Vladimir's death was a heavy loss for all Soviet people, but the pain that a father experiences with the loss of a son is especially great. He understood that in exploring a new field of human endeavor, casualties were inevitable among the trailblazers. How many brave souls perished before aviation became a safe means of transportation? Vladimir loved his parents, loved his country, but he had to fly. He died for a worthy cause, sparing the lives of others following after him. With the funeral completed, we'll move on to the accident investigation. At this time, all further piloted flights were indefinitely canceled. On April 27th, Ustinov met with the leading space industry representatives and established a special governmental commission, headed by himself, to determine the causes of the accident. The commission included 7 subcommissions. The commission included 2 representatives from the Central Design Bureau of Experimental Machines, Chief Designer Mishin and Deputy Chief Designer Bushayev, Soyuz 1 and 2 backup cosmonauts Gagarin and Baikovsky also served as members. Now, to understand how the accident happened, one needs to understand how the parachute system was supposed to work on the early Soyuz. The body of the descent module housed 2 containers for the parachute system, which were in the form of elliptical cylinders. The larger of the 2 was intended for the main parachute and the smaller for the backup system. The parachute bundles were pushed with great force into the cramped containers after the entire descent module had undergone heat treatment in a special autoclave at a temperature of several hundred degrees in order to polymerize the thermal protective coating. Before this, the openings of the empty containers must be covered with flight lids, since being part of the exterior surface of the descent module, they have the same thermal protective coating. During descent, upon reaching an external pressure that corresponds to an altitude of 9.5 kilometers, a special pressure unit issues the command to jettison the lid of the main parachute system. After the parachutes are packed and the lids closed, the containers are airtight, and normal atmospheric pressure is maintained inside them. When the container lids are jettisoned, the internal pressure of the container drops abruptly to the value corresponding to an altitude of 9.5 kilometers. The internal pressure of the descent module, which is close to 1 atmosphere, acts on the body of the container. Because of the differential pressure, compressive force acts over the entire surface of the container. The jettison lid sweeps the drogue parachute into the mainstream. These, in turn, pull out the braking parachute. The timing mechanism counts down a delay of 17 seconds needed for the braking parachute to balloon open and decelerate the descent module to the designated descent speed. Responding to the command issued after 17 seconds, the braking parachute begins to pull the bundle containing the main parachute out of the container. After the canopy of the main parachute enters the stream, the braking parachute flies away with the bag in which the main parachute was stowed. During descent, with the main parachute system, the impact velocity is around 7 meters per second. To reduce the G-force loads upon impact, an independent soft landing system is used. 1 meter from the ground, a gamma ray altimeter installed on the bottom of the descent module issues a signal to fire 4 solid fuel braking engines. This reduces the landing speed from 7 to 2.5 meters per second. During soft landing, the bottom of the descent module is deformed only slightly. The shock absorbers of the seats act as a backup means to reduce the G loads on the cosmonauts in the event the gamma ray altimeter or solid fuel engines fail. In order for the gamma ray altimeter and soft landing engines to operate at an altitude of around 3 kilometers, the main pressure unit issues a signal causing the massive heat shield enclosing the entire outer bottom of the descent module to be jettisoned. If the main chute fails, there is a second pressure unit that monitors the external pressure, and at an altitude of 5.5 kilometers, it operates a barometric instrument that measures pressure change during a fixed period of time. If the rate of pressure change exceeds the normal rate for the descent mode using the main parachute, then a command is issued to jettison the lid of the reserve parachute system. During a landing using the reserve parachute system, the soft landing system also reduces the impact velocity to 2.5 meters per second. Pyro cartridges are the final actuating element of all the commands. They jettison the hatches and braking parachute, and on the ground, the parachute cords. And where one pyro cartridge was sufficient in principle, there were at least 2 of them for reliability. In the electrical circuitry, all command-issuing instruments, relays, and cable network had redundancy. A single failure of any element of the electrical circuitry could not cause the failure of the main or reserve parachutes. By June 20, 1967, the investigation was complete. The State Commission identified the cause of the accident as a release failure in the container block of the primary parachute. The parachute was packed in the container whose hatch was jettisoned, releasing a braking or drag parachute, slowing down the vehicle to a manageable 40 meters per second, sufficiently slow to allow the primary parachute to fill up with air instead of being shredded. The drag parachute itself was supposed to pull out the main parachute, but it did not do so because the main parachute had gotten jammed in the container. Under nominal circumstances, automated instruments on board the capsule would have detected an increase in velocity and discarded the primary drag and main parachutes and activated the backup system. But on Soyuz 1, once instruments detected the velocity increase, the capsule was unable to discard the primary chute since it was still stuck in the container. This meant that the primary drag chute was still deployed above the spacecraft. Once the single backup parachute was released, it was to have come out in the shape of a long, thin cylinder and then unfurl to its dome shape. In Soyuz 1's case, the backup chute began to extend under the steel-attached drag parachute from the primary system. Hindered by the flailing drag chute, the backup parachute never filled with air. Without any means of braking, the ship plummeted and hit the ground at a velocity of 144 kilometers per hour, or 40 meters per second. An autopsy of Komarov confirmed that he died on impact with the ground and that the effects of the fire were secondary. Despite rumors to the contrary, Komarov did not cry or scream before the impact, although during the last seconds he was surely aware that he had little chance to live. Due to the rapid velocity of descent, the frontal heat shield was never discarded at an altitude of 3 kilometers, and the soft landing engines never fired prior to touchdown. The latter, in fact, detonated after landing, burning with the 30 kilograms of concentrated hydrogen peroxide from the capsule's attitude control engines. From launch to impact, Komarov's ill-fated flight had lasted 1 day, 2 hours, 47 minutes, and 52 seconds. The State Commission discovered that the reason that the primary parachute failed was due to friction within the container, between the parachute and the inside walls of the container. The increased pressure within the parachute container relative to the low pressure outside the vehicle caused the parachute to simply block up against the insides of the container. This effect was never detected on 4 drops of the parachute system prior to the flight. As late as 1990, Chief Designer Mission continued to believe that the parachute had been incorrectly packed during preparations. The solar panel failure was later traced to the panel getting snagged on the external vacuum shield cover of the spacecraft. The 45K attitude control sensor had failed due to a steam-up of its optical surface. The commission recommended redesigning the parachute container by making it conical instead of cylindrical, increasing its internal volume and polishing the inside walls. Additional measures would include installing an autonomous mode for separating the primary drag chute and photographing the assembly of the parachute packages. There was also an unofficial and perhaps more likely version of the cause of the accident, one that attributed the accident to gross negligence on the part of technicians at the Central Design Bureau of Experimental Machine Buildings Manufacturing Plant. During pre-flight preparations, the two Soyuz ships, 4 and 5, had been coated with thermal protection materials and then delivered into a high-temperature test chamber to polymerize the synthetic resin. In the case of the two Soyuz ships for the April 1967 mission, technicians baked the vehicles in the chamber with their parachute containers, but apparently without the covers for the containers. In Deputy Chief Designer Chertok's investigation of the matter in the early 1990s, he could not find anyone still alive who could remember why the covers had been left off. Due to the omissions of the covers, the interior of the parachute containers were coated with the polymerized resin that formed a very rough surface, thus eventually preventing the parachute from deploying on Soyuz 1. But the most chilling implication of this manufacturing oversight was that both Soyuz spacecraft were doomed to failure. If Komarov had not faced any troubles in orbit, and the Soyuz 2 launch had gone on as scheduled, it is likely all four cosmonauts would have been lost. The unofficial cause of the accident was never included in the official report on Soyuz 1, partly because those at the manufacturing plant who knew of the violation of testing procedure chose to remain silent on the issue so as not to incriminate themselves. This, of course, still doesn't explain why technicians never noticed the rough surfaces during the packing of the parachute. Perhaps Mission's assertion that the parachutes were packed incorrectly was also true. The existence of concurrent official and unofficial versions raises at least a question of how the Soviets managed crisis resolution in their space program in the 1960s. Clearly, job security for someone was a big factor in squelching the unofficial version of the events. Another casualty of the post-Soyuz 1 investigation was Chief Designer Tkachev of the Scientific Research and Experimental Institute of the Parachute Landing Service, who had designed the Soyuz parachute system. Although the unofficial version clearly exonerated his organization of any blame, Tkachev was fired from his job in 1968, ending his role in designing the parachute systems for Vostok, Voskhod, Zenit, Soyuz, and many other Soviet spacecraft of the era. Two parachute failures during tests following Soyuz 1 apparently sealed his fate. Through the years, there have been sporadic but unconfirmed reports of Komarov bidding his farewells in orbit, Komarov screaming to his death, and even Komarov attempting to repair his ship in space by climbing into inaccessible areas of his ship. All of these can be rejected as untruths or exaggerations. With regard to the foreign monitoring of his mission, there was one postscript to the mission that emerged 30 years after Soyuz 1. Boris A. Pokrovsky, a high-ranking official in the Command Measurement Complex, the Soviet Space Tracking Service, wrote in his memoir in 1996 that, quote, "I remembered that several days after Komarov's death, I was summoned by General A.G. Karas, who told me on the telephone to bring a tape recorder to his office. It turned out that the USSR Ministry of Foreign Affairs had forwarded a tape received via diplomatic channels from West Germany. Remembering that I knew a little German, Andrei Grigorievich invited me to listen to the tape that German specialist had recorded by radio containing several minutes of information from on board Soyuz 1. The specialist commentary on the tape was naturally in German. From Komarov's brief phrases, it was possible to conclude that he was somehow distraught, and later Through the radio noise, it was possible to hear the word killed, but no words were spoken on the parachute system. There were words on the rise of temperature inside the ship. The recording was made, apparently, on one of the last orbits, if not the final one. The German commentary was not especially interesting. End quote. In conclusion, the Soyuz 1 flight should not have been carried out when it was. The spacecraft was insufficiently tested in space conditions and was certainly not ready for an ambitious rendezvous first mission that it was scheduled to accomplish. When Brezhnev or Ustinov complained about the lack of Soviet success in space, it translated into political pressure on Mishin, Kerimov, Keldysh, and others. Thus, both sides made decisions that were counterproductive and eventually had fatal consequences to the Soviet space program. All told, the responsibility and guilt for the accident lay not on the conscience of any one man, but on the technological culture that considered high risk acceptable in the face of incessant political pressure from above. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 141 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Soyuz 1, The Crash. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I'd like to offer my sincere apologies for mispronouncing the Russian names, and I would like to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. And a special salute to my Mercury donors. These donors give at least $20 during a calendar year to support the podcast and get their name on the donors page at the Mercury level. Thank you for your continued support, Mercury donors. I'd like to remind everyone that episodes 121 through 141 are now available on YouTube. I put the link to the videos on Facebook, Twitter, and the homepage with the episode posting. I had a few afterthoughts on this episode. My hat is off to Vladimir Komarov. He did his duty to his country until the very end. He overcame many difficulties just to become a cosmonaut, and he was an excellent cosmonaut, whose bravery and dedication should never be questioned. Anyone willing to go in the Voskhod and the first Soyuz flight had to be courageous. Like the rest of the cosmonauts, Komarov knew this was a risky business and a very risky flight. He was very aware of the previous failures of the unmanned Soyuz flights, and yet he chose to take the risk and be the first. From my research, I have found the rumors that he lost control and said things that he shouldn't have during his descent to be untrue and unfair. The rumors should never be allowed to taint the character and performance of Komarov. In my research, I only found that he was professional to the end. I hesitated to even address the rumors, but since so much has been made of them, I felt I had to mention it. So, my hat is off to Vladimir Komarov, a great cosmonaut. If any good news can be taken from such an accident, it is the fact that only one cosmonaut was lost. If Soyuz 1 did not have the problems with the solar panel and the 45K sensor, then the Soviets certainly would have launched Soyuz 2, carrying three cosmonauts, Baikovsky, Krunov, and Yelizayev. After docking, Krunov and Yelizayev were supposed to transfer to Komarov's vehicle. In that case, the three of them would have perished, and shortly thereafter, it's quite likely that Baikovsky in Soyuz 2 would have perished too, since both of those Soyuz, number 4 and 5, had the parachute container flaw. So that is a little bit of good news. And lastly, I must say I am relieved to be finished with these two very sad and difficult missions, Apollo 1 and Soyuz 1. I look forward to covering happier, more successful missions, or at least missions where no one dies. We have reached the end of this long dark tunnel and should have some more positive missions for a while now. I posted several pictures for this episode on the website spacerockethistory.com. I hope you check them out. I'd also like to thank Joe G for sending in a beautiful fan artwork honoring Komarov that I posted on Twitter and Facebook this week. If you haven't seen it, check it out on Facebook, Twitter, and the homepage with this week's episode. And a little more good news. Dave has made it back from his honeymoon. Aussie HQ is now up and running. Hopefully we will get some new cartoons in the coming weeks. I was very pleased to receive donations to support the podcast this week. There were three. Gabriel V. from Sweden donated at the Orion level. Thank you very much, Gabriel. Mylene M. from California donated at the Sputnik level. Thanks, Mylene. And Nicholas from France pledged at the Gemini level on Patreon. Thanks, Nicholas. That brings our total Patreon donors to 33 with a goal of reaching 50. Keep in mind, now is a very good time to make a donation to the podcast. If you make a donation before the end of 2015, then you make a donation in 2016, you will get your rocket emoticon. So, if you are deriving value from this podcast, let me ask you one favor, and that is to donate to support the podcast. It doesn't have to be a lot and not more than you can afford. But the podcast is entirely listener-supported, so I depend upon you to keep it going. Donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page on the website, spacerockethistory.com, based on their donation level. You can make a one-time donation now by clicking on the orange Donate button on the homepage, or, if you prefer, you can click on the Patreon link on the homepage and donate a small amount monthly. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of the next episode, please follow me on Twitter and Facebook. The links are on the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. I want to thank those who follow me on Twitter, and thanks to those who liked the Facebook page this week. We're up to 712 likes. I was pleased to see the podcast received another 5-star ratings on iTunes this week. This one was anonymous, so whoever did that, I certainly do appreciate the all-important 5-star rating. We're up to 90 ratings in iTunes, only 10 away from 100. If you'd like to be notified when my next podcast is posted, you can sign up for the email list on the homepage. And I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Futurama King, Glenn Trudgett, Kadavi 1202, Renz Loing, E.G. Roberts, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, this is Alex Boyd, Metro Pop EU, Trivial Gravitas, Andy Cox, and Space Cowboy Sci-Fi. I really appreciate it. If I missed anyone, let me know and I will get you next week. If you'd like to be a retweeter, it's very simple. Follow me on Twitter at Space Rocket Hist. And when I send out a tweet, just retweet it to your followers. Okay, this is the end of the content for the episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thought I would give you folks who are interested enough to stick around to the end a heads up on some podcast topics I'm thinking about. Last week I told you what I plan to cover on the remainder of 1967. Since I'm all set to do the Soviet missions right now, I may go ahead and cover Venera 4 and the automated docking of the two Soyuz in the next couple of episodes. There will be an episode next week. It'll be released on Christmas Eve, unless I get it done before then. And the following week after that, I will be out of town and we will have an encore episode. In other podcast topics, I'm sure you recall we have the coveted rocket emoticon for donors who donate 2 years in a row. Well, when 2016 rolls around, I'll need to add another emoticon for donors who have donated 3 years in a row. I found something that is pretty appropriate, and I will disclose that emoticon next week. In listener news, I received a message from Ben D. from the UK, and he informed me that Tim Peake, who was launched to the International Space Station on Tuesday, became the first non-private British citizen to travel in space as a British citizen. All the previous Brits have been privately funded or gone as U.S. citizens. So this was a momentous occasion for the UK, and I'd like to congratulate Tim Peake and the UK for this outstanding accomplishment. Way to go, UK. And thanks to Ben for calling that to my attention. In personal news, I have been waiting 32 years for a certain movie to be released. You can probably guess what that is. If you've been alive in the past several months, you probably know what movie that is. I'm gathering most of my family together for a trip to the local movie theater to experience this movie. It is my fervent hope that J.J. Abrams did not mess this movie up. Anyway, we will find out on the 22nd of December. I'm doing my best to remain spoiler-free until I get to see it. It's going to be hard because the official debut is on the 18th of December. So that's going to take some effort to remain spoiler-free. Okay, that's enough of that stuff. Hope to have episode 142 ready by next Thursday. So long for now.